Welcome, Spartans, to the latest podcast of our book club. I'm your host today, David, and with me is Aaron.
Hi, guys.
And Krista.
Hello.
That's right, no Oren, because he sucks.
Didn't finish the book. He's not allowed to be here.
Goddamn book. And this time, we are talking about The Thursday War, which is the second book in the Kilo 5 trilogy written by the lovely Karen Travis. And it's pretty damn good. Hopefully, you should not be listening to this unless you've listened to and or read The Glasslands. Sorry, because obviously it's the second book in the trilogy. It's going to be spoilers for all sorts of stuff. So heads up, we will probably be spoiling some stuff in Halo 4 and maybe a little bit talking about some of the Forerunner trilogy books based on kind of where the story goes, the kind of things that that tie into it. This book was, as we said, written by Karen Travis. Publisher was Tor Books. Its format is pretty much everything. You get the hardback, softback print, ebook, and audio. Actually, is there hardbacks? Probably no hardbacks for Halo books. I don't think I've seen a hardback for.
I think it did say in Halopedia that there's a hardback version, although I've never seen the hardback of the Kilo 5 trilogy.
I've only seen the hardback of the Forerunner trilogy. But I'm sure it exists.
Yeah, I think because these books came out at the same time, for some reason the Forerunner trilogy and the Kilo 5 trilogy get hardbacks, and then it's back to paperback novels.
Yeah, that's weird. Okay. So they're out there. If you want them, go find them. The release date was the 2nd of October 2012. Its length is 488 pages. Or whatever size your Kindle thing does it for. So, I'll give you a quick kind of time of the synopsis. This is humanity's new war, the silent, high stakes, and unseen. This is the life or death mission for Oni's Black Ox team, Kilo 5, which is tasked with preventing the ruthless elites, once the military leaders of the Covenant, from regrouping and threatening humankind again. What began as a routine dirty tricks operation, keeping the elites busy with their own insurrection, turns into a desperate bid to extract one member of Kilo 5 from the seething heart of the alien civil war. But trouble never comes singly for Kilo 5. Colonial terrorism is once again surfacing on one of the worlds that survived the war against the Covenant, and the man behind it is much more than just the name Spartan 010. Spartan name 2, Spartan 010. That's Naomi. Meanwhile, the treasure trove of foreign technology recovered from the Shield World Onyx is about to be put to work with the kidnapped elite, plots vengeance on humans, and he fears of brings people to the brink of destruction. So all hints there. The timeline is around the 24th of March 2553. We have various locations that are touched on in this book. We will talk to them as we get to them. We return to some amazing characters, as you can expect. There's not too many, which is pretty good in this trilogy, in terms of not crazy amounts of people, but the story's good in terms of it's kind of centered and focused on one or two key locations. And the trilogy itself has been very good at that. You know, it's about a team of people and kind of follows them. It does kind of hop around a little bit, but doesn't do the crazy amount of stuff that Halo does. And it does a pretty good job of introducing some amazing characters. Or keeping up their introduction the day before. What do you guys think? How are we getting on? How's Thursday War treating you?
It's the biggest side quest ever.
It sure is.
It's like, man, we gotta catch this guy in Venezia, but first let's start a civil war.
Yeah, so the end of Glasslands kind of gives you the big reveal of Naomi's father is not a leader, but I think at the time he's on the Terror Watch list. Is he considered down as a leader?
He's like one of the top people in this whole organization.
Has he been identified as a top person yet, or was he just a person of interest?
No one knew he was alive for a while. And no one put two and two together, but no, he's high in this organization. Like he's not completely in charge, but he's definitely up there because he makes the decision to, we'll cover it later, but he goes after some Covenant hardware and he makes that decision and he's getting it for the cause. It's kind of back to the insurrection now of not having like one man in charge, but he's definitely for Venezia. He's like one of the top dogs.
Okay. Well, that kind of touches like the end of the book, essentially, because like Krista says, it's a big ass side quest. So the book kind of starts with the reveal, continuing on from Glasslands, and the kind of the team Kilo 5 essentially get kind of wrapped away. So Aaron, you're going to talk us through the kind of main points of the story. So why don't you kind of kick us off?
We'll like bounce through this as we go. So like this literally takes place the second after Glasslands ends. And Glasslands ends on the dramatic note of an explosion. Phillips, if you'll remember, gets invited by the Arbiter to come down to... They pronounce it Sangelios in these books instead of Sanghelios. But I used to always pronounce it Sanghelios.
I always say Sanghelios. I'm pretty sure it's the way to say it in Halo 5 too.
The narrator pronounces it Sangelios and Sangheli. Or Sangili, not Sangheili.
We know not to trust audiobooks, though.
Yeah, that can be a little weird. So if I bounce back and forth between that, it's because I've been listening to the audiobook. Phillips was invited there, and Phillips decides to take a sneaky adventure to go and meet Telcam in his temple. It's a forerunner, like a forerunner building. And then there's a big dramatic explosion. And the last thing we hear in Glasslands is, I think it's Telcam, like, shouting just before the comms cut off, going, "That wasn't us, it wasn't us," and then it cuts out. And then suddenly Kilo 5 have to pack up and they abandon Venezia and they race back to St. Helios to go and see what's happening with Phillips. And it's all very tense and dramatic.
It's very nice.
And they cover all the things that we're used to in Halo, where they like jump to slip space and then they've got no communications, so they can't like get any updates. They just have to like hold their breath and wait till they get there. And we have the usual, we jump close, but it's not accurate.
Yeah, they're really hammering home those points for like later in the story where everything changes. So it's kind of interesting.
Because this is where we're getting into, this book in particular covers a lot of the technical advances that the UNSC are going to make between now and Halo 4.
It's pretty great. It does a good job of like, when you think about, like, there is a significant time gap between Halo 3 and 4, 4 and something years. And, like, obviously the war isn't static then. And obviously where the way things end in Halo 3 and the way they picked up in Halo 4 is, okay, the Infinity is a thing. Where the hell did that come from? If you were like me and you hadn't read these beforehand, all you knew was some of the promotional materials for the game for Halo 4 that kind of introduced Infinity. But, like, it really gets introduced in these books, in these stories.
Oh yes, they completely roll into it because, as a side note for trivia, Thursday War is like war training in the Royal Navy. It's like a training war for officers, usually happens on a Thursday, and the Thursday War in this case is like the Infinity's first test mission. It's going to come up in this. So they race back to, you'll have to help me here in case I miss some of these points, they race back to St. Helios. We have, I believe, Hood and Parangoski are having like a tour of the Infinity as all the shit starts to hit the fan. So they've both gone to have a look at their prized baby.
One thing that kind of stood out to me, the marketing material for Halo 4 marketed the Infinity as a ship commissioned for peace and all this kind of bullshit. And it really didn't strike me as like being marketing PR in the terms of how the UNSC were marketing it. And when you see in the background of what's actually happening, where UNSC and ONI went halves on this in order to make it happen. And it's very much a ship not designed for peace. It is designed to be the pinnacle of everything humanity can
actually
achieve.
Isn't there an interesting, I can't remember the exact details, but we also find out from the fleet manual that Infinity wasn't even designed to be like the biggest badass warship. It was designed to be like a lifeboat for humanity in the event that Earth was destroyed by the Covenant.
Oh, was it like an ark? That's very interesting.
The Infinity and her sister ship, I think it's Eternity. They were building two of them, and the plan was that they would like have the best of the best of humanity, and if all else failed, they would flee out into the galaxy. That was her original purpose. But then
that makes sense. That's crazy.
Things went well, and we got some goodies. Then we got to do fun stuff.
And now it's just like the UNSC putting their dick on the table. They just show up and they're like, "Here's my penis."
And it's funny, they make jokes about it in the story.
Every time I think of Infinity, I think of that Spartan Ops intro cutscene where it smashes through the Covenant ship. And you're just like,
I love that.
This is us now. This is the Infinity. So it's awesome.
It's really cool, humanity being the big power in the universe at this point.
It's great to see this naval warfare take such a rapid turn. And it's really interesting because, like, you read these books and, like, there's a lot of Halo, pre-Halo 4, let's say, books of the Covenant War. Like, there's tons of it. And in all of it, humanity sucks. Humanity gets ass kicked. And it's awesome to see the tables turned. To see, like, humanity being a success, having the technological advantage. And obviously, they hint on it big in this book of that came because the Huragok, we got them and they lost them. And that was the huge tipping point of what allowed us to do and how like Infinity got retrofitted with a crap ton of technology that we got from Onyx or Trevelyan. So like that's a huge kind of plot point as well, and location of where we go in the story. So it's really cool to see all this stuff come together to see how we use it.
Yeah, and they also do a lot of good inter-character stuff, because during the start bit, like when they're making their way back to San Helios, you've got the ODSTs are coming back to Port Stanley, and they're having an argument over, you know, who do they tell first? Do they tell Naomi about her dad, or do they tell Osman? What do they do? And this causes like a bit of drama. And then on the way back, you've got them like trying to figure out if Naomi's all right, because I think Vaz talks about it, how he figures out very quickly that Naomi's tell that she like can't deal with personal issues. Is she just like hesitates for half a second and freezes, and then she like gets her Spartan composure back and pretends everything's fine. So like you have all this going on in the meantime, while they're trying to like get back to see if they can get Phillips. And then it bounces back to Phillips.
He's having a great time.
He's really in the middle of the shit. He's gone from being like the amusing little mammal that unlocks arums to the shit's hitting the fan. The temple and the square have been bombed. Telcam very quickly figures out that it's the brutes. Phillips is like still, his ears are ringing. He's freaked out. He can't really breathe. And Telcam's already like standing up, looking around going, where the fuck are the brutes? The brutes were there a minute ago. Now there's no brutes. And then the brutes attack. They have suddenly realized that the brutes have made a move. And this kicks Telcam's plans up. They hadn't planned on like making a move, but they've suddenly realized that if they don't go now, they're going to end up fighting a battle with the elites or with the Arbiter and the brutes at the same time. So it's like, we've got to mobilize now, we've got to take out the brutes, and then we've got to go for the Arbiter as quick as we can.
Yep.
The revolution does not get off to a good start. Also, fun fact, in the middle of all this like attack in the square when Phillips is there, we find out that an elite lynch mob is to eat the person.
Yeah, they're eating people.
No, that's pretty, yeah, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that. I prefer a good old-fashioned hanging.
Yeah.
Because Phillips like says it, it's like, these are carnivores. They don't hang their people, they munch them.
Yeah, that's, yeah, it's pretty visual in what's going on. Also important to know, in the explosion, the fragment of BB gets damaged. That's kind of a pretty big plot point in Phillips's side story.
It does. It saves, funnily enough, it saves Phillips's life. Because Telcam, like, Phillips realizes the radio's been damaged, and Telcam takes a look and he's like, the gods must want you to survive. And then Phillips has to, like, figure something out. So the radio receiver, which, by the way, the radio receiver, because Phillips isn't a trained agent, the radio receiver had a lethal injection inside that BB was supposed to pump into Phillips if he was taken for interrogation, which I love when they prep Phillips for going down. I think they said to him, you have to wear this radio at all times. And he's like, what about the shower? He's like, find somewhere to put it. It's just like, you have this on you at all times, and BB will kill you at the first sign of trouble.
And BB's like, I'm here for you, Professor.
Yeah.
But I'm going to murder your ass. So Phillips like pulls the shrapnel out of this and accidentally triggers the tamper mechanism in the radio. So BB, the fragment of BB, automatically deletes all of his confidential classified and like top secret stuff. Classified, that's the word. So he deletes all that, and then we basically get the BB version of Siri.
He also deletes
Siri.
His capabilities as well, so he can only do very rudimentary things.
It's like having an Alexa.
Alexa.
But way more useful.
Yeah. Well, and also he's really sad. Like, this BB is just like, I don't know what's going on. I can't remember anything.
A lot of interesting character development goes on with BB in this book, and definitely in terms of exploring some of the stuff about AIs, which is kind of obviously very up to date or very at the fore of the Halo universe right now, is what AIs are doing.
Relevant.
So, relevant, that's the word. So, also, it's kind of interesting to see they kind of described you from the AI's point of perspective, how they comprehend pain and how they kind of feel it. And that, you know, literally if they're not, they're all taught. So to not think is to die. So like when you lose part of your memory and stuff like that, that's distressful to them, like greatly so. And it's kind of interesting to see that.
BB's biggest trauma in this is that he was linked to that fragment when it's cut off. So like he describes it as losing like a limb almost. If to think is to breathe, then this is the equivalent of like involuntarily having your arm taken off. So he's had this trauma and he's not sure what's going to happen now because he has no clue that his fragment has like partially survived. And then you have the fragment of Baby who's kind of, he's kind of like he's experiencing rampancy. And at the same time, I also wonder, it seems more like he's become like nearly like his pre-donor self. We don't touch on that in this book, but he seems more like just a frightened human trapped in a radio than an AI. He's lost all of his like AI awesomeness. And it makes you wonder, is he closer to who BB was originally?
Yeah.
I'd say a whole BB might be closer to that because they have way more personality than this fragment ever did. And definitely what he lost all that. I think he lost the personality that made him more human-like as opposed to gaining anything.
The thing is, the personality of the AI isn't the personality of the donor. So I kind of wonder is when they stripped all of his AI-ness away from him, I feel like what he has left is closer maybe to the original. Be kind of like if you stripped all of Cortana's awesomeness away from her, you just get a Halsey.
I don't think you would.
I don't know.
To strip an AI-ness, as you said, from an AI, I think it's just to kill the AI. Because then it just becomes dumb. It just becomes a program.
But like, isn't the original template of the AI just a template of the human? It develops from there.
Well, it's like you're saying the person who recorded the voice lines for Alexa, if you strip everything away, is it going to be just that person again?
Yeah. I don't think when you like map, there is a pretty deep now, but like the mapping or the starting of a human brain, I don't think that you don't, they don't get memories from it, right? They don't.
They do. I think didn't that happen in, isn't that the point of the season 2 of Hunt the Truth? She was recalling this stuff as an AI because she was interacting with BB.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Pharaoh?
Oh, I don't know.
I think I remember that's what that discussion was because she was starting off life as an AI because they took her brain after she died and she still remembered all the stuff she did as a human. I think this was like the pre-prep work, so I don't know. Anyway, we've got Phillips on the ground and suddenly Phillips realizes he is now a hostage of Telcam. Because Telcam can't afford to let him go. He's trying to get back to the Arbiter. Phillips, like, slipped away from his bodyguard and then suddenly realizes it was a terrible time to slip away from his bodyguard.
Yep.
And now he's stuck at the temple. And you get, I think, like, as the story goes on, you get a lot of fun stuff with Phillips while he's there. Like, he has to adjust to life living with elites. He talks about their dog food dinner.
He does a lot of the growth development here and he comes out the other side a bit more enthused about his position and definitely more like, you see him always flashing back and talking about like all the things when the ODSTs tried to tell me these things and I kind of laughed or I didn't really see the significance of them, but now he does in terms of cleaning clothes and always being clean in the field because you could be just stuck with what you've got and that's what you have to make the most of and not having enough rations and all this kind of stuff. So it was interesting to see him reflect on that.
He's becoming like a secret agent.
That's it. Like he's trial by fire and he comes out the other side pretty well, I think, in the end. I mean, if you want to just talk about just his arc for the moment and just kind of wrap that up, I mean, he stays in the temple.
Yeah, he revives the BB fragment and then he starts to explore this temple because they don't think he can get out of it. It's a load of tunnels underneath this temple. So as best he can figure out, it was some sort of forerunner like garrison. And he starts to explore through it and BB's able to like help him with some translation and recording. So they're working their way through and it has very similar vibes to Ghost of Onyx in that, and Glasslands as well, where he's walking through and they have stone on the wall that reshapes itself. They have these stone displays where they describe it as a furry barrier, which I think one of the engineers reveal. It's like, it's how the engineers interact with the consoles and the data. It's their interactive field, so it feels like a furry barrier to us, but it's actually what they use to interact with the equipment. So he explores through this and he finds symbols that he finds a few things. He finds like hints to warnings about like what does he call them at one stage, a didactic leader, a teacher. So he finds some warnings to this, and then he also finds some symbols, 7 of them, where one is different to the other 6, and then he puts 2 and 2 together and realizes they might be coordinates for the halos. But he can't figure out at this stage that, like, how can this symbol be different when they're carved in stone? And then he makes the discovery that the stone changes, and then he, for a while, he accidentally thinks he's primed the halos to activate them, and then even dumb BB's intelligent enough to go like, I'm sure they designed a safety protocol so illiterate aliens couldn't fire off the weapons of mass destruction.
It's a fun moment, though. It's a super fun moment.
Yeah, where he has this moment of like, uh-oh.
Did I just prime the halos?
Yeah, and he thinks he also finds information for, he finds references to sarcophagus, which is Trevelyan, and then other shield worlds as well. So he potentially has a lot of useful information now. He explores deeper into the temple. He like takes food and preps it, hoping he might be able to like make a run at some point. And then conveniently he discovers an arum in the wall.
Yeah,
that was cool.
Yeah, I like that they tie that into, he suddenly realizes that the arum puzzles are based on these locking devices, and these are locks to portals. So this sets up in Halo 4, we have a lot of portals. We don't teleport anywhere anymore. We use portals and we go through them. And he goes through this portal and he ends up in the middle of a field.
Yeah.
And has a very hilarious encounter with some grunts.
Oh my God, it's amazing.
He meets some grunts and he has them. It's a place called a Crowley. I'm going to pause there for a second and bounce back then, because we've got to go back to Port Stanley and the stuff that they're doing in the meantime, because they arrive at San Helios and they start to lay down their first plan. So like they start to scan the planet. They're trying to figure out what's going on. They're watching like the battles as they happen. And then they eventually negotiate with the Arbiter to like get down to the planet to send a team down. So they send Kilo 5 down to look for Phillips. So they go to the temple. And then conveniently, because they also have telecams permission, in theory, no one should be shooting at them, but people are shooting at them.
People are always shooting at them.
Yes, people are always shooting.
You can't really overstate how significant it is that humans are on San Helios.
Oh, yes.
In terms of, like, that's a huge deal. So, like, they're not used to that. I mean, obviously, Phillips being allowed to go there was a big deal. But armed military humans arriving is going to be send off, like, crazy signals.
It plays in pretty seriously to, like, it kind of backfires on the Arbiter in a while.
Yeah, which you kind of think he should have known. I thought that was kind of stupid. Like, you're giving them permission to go into a temple. That's crazy. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, like, he must have been just not thinking at all there.
Yeah, so they land, they get out. Naomi does some awesome Spartan stuff and like leaps up walls and takes out brutes and
just as awesome.
Yeah, they get into the temple and they lock the gates, and then they're talking to BB. He's in Naomi's suit and they're negotiating to get into the temple to look for Phillips, and then BB's also filling them in on like the crowd outside, and they're like, I think it's Mal or someone asked like, what are they talking about out there, BB? And it's like, the gist of the conversation is they're trying to decide, can we kill infidels in a temple, or do we need to drag them out and kill them first? This is like the discussion outside. The crowd are all waiting going like, kill them in the temple, does that defile the temple, do we need to drag them out and kill them out here? And so Naomi's like, we should lock the gates and get moving. So they lock the gates and then they run like fuck into the temple and they start to search for Phillips.
And then the temple becomes surrounded, right? Like a bunch of people come in.
The mob like basically break the door down and get into the front yard of the temple. So Devereaux has to move the Pelican around to like the back of the temple, and then the team are moving through down below, and funny, BB is sniffing for Phillips.
Yeah, that was really cool.
There's a funny interaction where Naomi's like, how are you sniffing for Phillips? Are you using my nose? And he's like, no, I'm using the sensors in your suit, you dumbass.
It's funny how like Spartans are almost, Spartan 2s were definitely designed to be interfaced with an AI, and yet I think the only one we know for sure that's really done it is Chief and Cortana. So like Naomi is super against it, which is kind of really interesting. I mean, I don't know if it's specific BB, but she's very much not ready for that.
No, she hasn't done it. Like the only other Spartan 2 we've ever seen with an AI in his helmet is Jerome in Halo Wars 2. Like that's it up until now. And she's like definitely creeped out by it a little bit. It's like, if I put you in my helmet, you're not allowed to tamper with my bodily functions at all. It's like, don't do anything unless I'm in serious trouble.
You see the bad version, because Fred got almost taken over by an AI, like a foreign AI was very much trying to kill him in his suit. So like you can see the negatives.
Yeah, but that only got into his suit though. It never got it into his head, at least.
I think they have to be put into the interface to go into their head.
You've got to be in the port in the back of the head. So that's really what like unsettles her, but they go through anyway. and they eventually get to the portal at the end, but conveniently, because Phillips took the key, they pass through the portal, nothing happens, and they come out to a door at the other end and suddenly realize they've come back out into the garden behind the temple.
And they have to bail because things go crazy.
Yeah, they have to bug out, and then they're like starting a search pattern to try and figure out where Phillips is, and BB's figures this out. And then we jump again to, in while all this is happening, Telcam goes off to get his ships because he left his ship at Julim Dama's keep. And then we meet Raya, Jule's wife.
I love Raya. She's a great character.
She's one of the first, I think, kind of female Sangheili we get introduced to, and she's awesome.
Yes, they do a really good job with her the whole way through this. So, like, she decides, okay, if the monk's coming for his ship, I'm going to stand here on the ramp. I'm armed. You're going to tell me where the fuck my husband is. And then Telcam's like, I can't really tell you much of anything. And he's like,
and then she's like, take me with you.
And she ends up basically negotiating to go with him. So she goes with Telcam and Jules' friend Forze, who's another keep leader. What's the word?
Kaidan.
He goes with her too. And the whole time on their entire adventure, Forze spends his whole time going, Jules going to fucking kill me. I've taken his wife to battle. And then there's one stage later where Raya's suddenly like, why do men get to do all this? Why don't we get involved in all this? And he's like, Jules going to kill me.
Her development is excellent. And even just to see her point of view from, say, even just the two Sangheili's kind of point of view of their race, and like how it's so crazily divided between the males and what their job is and the females and what their job is, and to suddenly see those kind of responsibilities kind of cross, and to see how she develops and sees this is like a whole new world that she didn't know existed was happening right beside her, and this is like training up the sons just to become this and ship them out, and then the refusal for like any kind of medical aid and stuff like that.
Well, and she's never even been out of her keep.
That's great too, to see the scale of her world.
She'd never been on a warship, but she's like never even seen her keep from the air before, and suddenly she's away off on this like battle adventure with Telcam.
And her ship gets crashed and she kind of survives that, and then she's kind of in front of the Arbiter's keep and all the forces are coming, and just to see it kind of like what she thought a siege was, and she's kind of like alternating between what Jewel had told her about humans and about this and that in terms of what actually it's like when you're there is kind of fascinating. And just to always see her develop and constantly be thinking about like what her life was and what she thought about it when she was kind of ignorant of what was happening and stuff was awesome. I loved it. I just loved her arc and how she was just like, the world has changed. Sangheili must change. Our ways must change too. It's not all about tradition.
I think she would have been a really cool character to see further on in the Halo series and be a big push for change for the Sangheili, but...
Yeah, I kind of feel like they take this as the foundation to when you get to like Legacy of Onyx, there are other female elites that kind of like take up the mantle from her. But no, they do a really good job with developing her, and this is the changing attitude to life with the elites isn't going to be the same, and the women aren't going to... I think the first sign of change with this is in Halo 5, one of the Phantom pilots is a female elite.
Well, and one of the later on in the siege, when Telcam is gathering his other ships, one of the shipmasters is a female.
Really?
Yeah.
In this book?
Yes, in this book, because she talks. They're talking. It's with the it's when the Kigyar, quote unquote Kigyar ship, is helping them destroy the Arbiter ships, and she comes on the radio and says something, and all the men on the bridge are just.
Is that not Osman?
That was Osman.
That's just Osman, I think.
The Kigyar was Osman.
Yeah, but that's who they were all silent listening to. It wasn't a female shipmaster.
There was a female shipmaster because Raya was like, oh, they do have female shipmasters.
Oh. She was talking about this character in the past and setting a precedence. I don't think she was talking about one that currently lived.
I think I'm with David. I don't...
That was my interpretation of that.
At least in the audiobook, there was no mention of it. They were all...
It was towards the very end. It was right before Raya gets click-clacked.
I thought that was just Osman and the back and forth about who's were.
Yeah, because she was talking to Forza saying, like, there has been... person in the past, a female warrior, let's say.
And she's a female swordmaster's one, and she's like,
yeah, female
swordmaster. It doesn't matter how many, it's just the fact that there's been one.
That was the conversation, in terms of obviously she doesn't want to go back to being like a...
And then at the end, it was all Osmond masquerading as this female jackal.
Kigar, yeah,
ship mistress.
Yeah.
She was this anyway. Kigar with this mystery ship. Well, anyway, yeah, like we said, she goes with Telcam. They go to fight the Arbiter. His ship gets shot down. They think they're going to die. They survive the crash. Then they think they're going to be hunted. Then they find out that people have rallied to Telcam's cause because word of the demon defiling the temple has got out. And suddenly all the keeps start to unite behind Telcam and decide that enough is enough and the Arbiter's gone too far. So they all start to like gather at the foot of the mountain outside the Arbiter's keep in Vidam. And it becomes this weird siege where they all gather up out the front and they fling pot shots at him, but they don't want to level the keep. They want to get in there and kill the Arbiter and take the keep. So it becomes like a long-running standoff.
The slow build of force. Because then you have the Port Stanley and Osmond trying to keep track of the whole thing of their main mission is obviously to keep the Sangheili fighting each other as long as possible and weaken both sides.
Yes, they have to keep it balanced the whole way through it.
You get a lot of politics coming in and out and flying back between Lord Hood and Paranoski on Infinity when that's been kind of geared up. And yeah, you get the Arbiter kind of thrown in the mix and you get like Osmond keeping track of the forces and the slow build and Arbiter's allies are not coming. It's just the Northern Hemisphere of St. Heliosan.
Everyone's sitting waiting to see what's going to happen. They're all hedging their bets. And then you've got this moment where Parangoski convinces Hood that we should really take the Infinity for a joyride.
Oh, it's an awesome moment.
It's like, we'll take this boat for a spin and we'll go and we'll help your friend out. Because, you know, your friend that you signed a peace treaty with is in desperate need of help. Because she's like contriving and twisting so much
stuff.
Their
conversations together are amazing. Their chemistry of between Hood and Paranoski are flying back. It's awesome. Every conversation of them, every scene with them is so entertaining.
Yeah, because you know that the whole time Hood's sitting there going, I know exactly what you're up to, but I can't call you on it because it's like, it's the unspoken rule that we're all doing this for the greater good. And even though you might like fuck a few things up for each other, we don't speak of it. And this is our first introduction to, when we go back to the Infinity and we go to Parangoski, this is where we're first introduced to Del Rio. And yeah, this is important because this is the first time that we find out that Del Rio is not, he's not like the hero captain that people are going to respect. Like Parangoski calls it, her choice to captain the Infinity from the start is Lasky, but she gets Lasky in as the XO and then Hood gets Del Rio. He's her man. Or he's his man.
But the way he describes him is perfect in terms of like he knows exactly what he is and what he's getting and that he's a by the book kind of guy. So like I think that's the kind of guy they wanted in charge of such a huge and important ship.
Parangoski sneaks off from the tour because she's like the first like unscheduled interaction on a ship is usually how you get to judge a ship. And she sees some civilian workers and she says they like slip past this guy at the door of the engineering section without looking at him or really paying too much attention. She's like, that's Del Rio and that's what this is. They listen to him. They might even respect him, but no one will die for him. Whereas Lasky has the Captain Keyes factor.
Yes, he does.
Which Del Rio does not, which is why Chief does not surrender that AI.
Yeah, but it's an awesome
give me that
setup
chip
of like these characters that are awesome in Halo 4 and like they set you up for not, but understanding more of who Del Rio is, but also why you won't like him. And do you know what I mean? And that makes perfect sense, as well as like Lasky, who is a character that's been built across multiple different media types. I've just watched Forward of the Dawn, so like he begins his story there, so you get to see who he is and his connection to Chief. And it's interesting, he's not a big character in this book, but his importance of being the XO and what his duties are interesting to see. And definitely, obviously, like you said, the two. It's interesting to see Oni picking the hero type character as opposed to like a devious, you know, kind of person that you might expect to be in charge of such a ship.
Hood says to her at one stage, he says to Parangoski, he's like, how come you always go for the salt of the earth, like man of the people types? And she's like, because it's so unlike me. And like, that's her, you know, that's her pick for this. So they roll out in the Infinity, and I think Osman's telling Kilo 5 that at one point, and they're like, are they both allowed to go out into battle on the same ship? And they're like, yes. And then I think BB steps in and says, like, well, if Parangoski dies, like, you're the heir apparent, you'll be fine. Like, Fleet might have a few problems for a while, but that's not our problem.
Yeah.
And, like, they sort of talk about, like, they've been hinting at just how powerful the Infinity is. So, like, this is all going to be its, like, great demonstration.
And it's such an amazing demonstration. And I love that it even causes panic within, like, Port Stanley and the crew in terms of, okay, this thing is about to happen. We don't want their success to be too successful so that, like, the Arbiter, it becomes completely in power. Like,
BB runs a lot of cool interference.
Interference and stuff. Yeah, he does really good stuff. And there has, like, okay, the AI on the ship is Anya, who is designed around getting a ship ready for battle as opposed to anything. Like, she's not a combat AI.
Yeah, she's like a shipbuilding AI. And the funny, they have this interesting thing about how Del Rio couldn't pick an AI. He couldn't settle on one. And they, like, Parangoski threatens him with picking one. So I assume Roland was Lasky's choice because, fun fact, Anya was the AI running Infinity during the Halo 4 campaign, and Cortana kills her by accident.
Yeah.
Oh, I totally forgot about
Remember, when Cortana has her freakout on the bridge in the console and, like, the power surges, she accidentally destroys Anya in the processors. And then when we come to Spartan Ops, we get Roland, who I assume then was Lasky's pick as AI.
That's crazy, man. I totally forgot about that.
So poor Anya gets wiped out on top of everything else.
BB kind of, like, messes with her the entire time, too.
He really does.
He is. And, like, I think at one stage he says it as, don't worry, she won't even know I rifled through her underwear drawer. And you're like, BB, behave yourself.
He's a great character, though. I think it's when all this is going on, you see the scramble of Osman of, like, trying to get tell Cam subtly, but then also not so subtly, get ready to fucking lose. Like, because he's like, all his forces are amassing towards the Arbiter. He's about to, like, he feels in power, and then he gets this call from Osman going, you're going to die.
Yeah, he's totally winning right up until the point that he doesn't.
Yeah.
When the Infinity steps in and starts macking.
I love
shit.
That conversation where she's talking to him, going, trust me, use your scanners and look up. And if you don't believe me, do you know? And then he calls her back within, like, a few minutes, and his tone is totally different. His character is totally, like, subdued, where he's like, where did you get that?
Yeah, both Telcam and the Arbiter kind of have the same thing where it's like, what the what now? And I think Telcam, yeah, at one stage, he says to Raya, because she's like, well, like, what do we have to fear from these humans? And Telcam's like, wait until sunset and you'll figure out why we have something to worry about with these humans. And that's because he's like, you're going to see the Infinity in the sky with the naked eye. She's so big. She's just sitting there waiting.
It's nuts.
Just before Infinity steps in and acts, Kilo 5 rescue Phillips. He pops up in a field and he goes to the nearest keep, which he meets some grunt stoners. And him and the grunt stoners, yep, go to the keep, and the females are minding the keep because the males have gone off to fight the Arbiter. And it turns out that while they've gone off to fight the Arbiter, the neighbouring keep has decided they want to take the land. So they're now attacking the females. Phillips gets roped into defending the homestead because the females are going to basically auction him off then as a hostage. Kilo 5 land in and kind of, like, they beat off the second wave of the attack. The housewives beat off the first phase. Kilo 5, like, fend off the second wave. And then they extract Phillips. And then Phillips has, like, a moment where the reality of working for Oni clashes with him as a good person because he realizes that the females, once they leave, the females are doomed. And this plays on him for a while because he, like, wants updates and stuff later. So they have to, like, drag Phillips away. And then, because the keep told Telcam that they had Phillips, he sends Forze, and Forze takes Raya to go and rescue him. So then you have this interaction where they're like, no, 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 we need to take him back to Telcam. And then Phillips is, like, shouting out of the back of the thing to Forze because he knows him, going, like, no, 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 Telcam's going to give me to these people anyway. So you can just, like, leave me here. And they eventually, they reach an agreement and they get a hold of each other. And
they help fix the ship and all that.
Yeah, they give them some parts. And then Kilo 5 go back out into orbit, where they break down on their way out of orbit. So they have to get rescued by Infinity. And funny, it was something I never picked up on until I was going through it after Halo 4, but they mentioned the underslung frigates.
Yeah.
This is just the size of Infinity, where she has, I think, 6 or 8 frigates housed in bays underneath the ship. Because yep. That was, I think there was like an interview with some developers after Halo 4 where they talked about they wanted to like convey the scale of the Infinity. And at one stage they talked about how you'd have the Infinity would roll in, the frigates would roll out of the Infinity, Pelicans would roll out of the frigates, the Pelicans would land on Requiem, and then the Spartans would roll out of the Pelicans. And they were like, it was going to be like just Russian dolls, and things were going to keep coming out smaller just to convey how big this ship is. Because I think the Infinity's, what, 6 kilometers long?
Something, yeah, just under 6K, and 17,000 people. They keep talking about it as if it's a city, is the way they describe it, like a city in space.
And they've taken it out with a, they say skeleton crew, but that's being generous, because I think there's like 300 people on this ship. This ship built for 70,000, and there's 300 on board.
17,000.
Is it 17? Oh, 17.
Yeah.
17,000, yeah, not 70. Yeah, just a wee bit. It's not like an Enterprise kind of crazy size, but it's...
It's bigger than the Enterprise.
Is it? 17,000 people?
I think the Enterprise is only like 1,000. The Enterprise is quite small.
Okay.
This is... The Infinity's up there with like Super Star Destroyer. I think they're a similar scale.
That's good.
It's big.
It's a big boy. They rescue Kilo 5, and this is where we get Pimp My Ride.
Yeah. They get the Hurrogok back.
Yep. Kilo 5 go on the bridge to watch what's happening with the battle, and the Hurrogok go off to fix the Pelican, and then Devereaux and Naomi, while they're on the bridge, they're watching this like real-time holographic super display that they have, and they're looking at the battle and all the rest, and Devereaux's like, I need some of this shit. So she nods to Naomi, and the two of them go off to find the engineers.
It's a cool moment, even like the Infinity's travel space, where when it goes from where it was being built to here, that's where they really start hammering home all those advancements. So they talk about they have these Forerunner engines that allow them to true slip space faster and like perfectly accurate than ever before. They have communications while they're in slip space, which is a massive, massive deal. So Del Rio is constantly saying, if we had this, we would have won the war. I wish I could fight the war with this thingy.
Yeah, BB says, like, how he describes it, I think, how they used to fight the war was, you know, he says, so no more bottles over the side of the ship. You know, it's no more messaging of bottles. They're not waiting for beacons. And basically, if they had have had this technology, Halo Wars 1 wouldn't have ended with the Spirit of Fire being lost, because they'd have been able to send a message from Slipspace or while they were about.
Yeah, exactly. And then their scanning and imaging is, like, way more impressive than before. So if you've played Halo 4, and you would know what like the imaging is like, because you've seen that awesome kind of table that shows you everything in 3D and scanned and everything.
And if you've played Halo 5, funnily enough, the upgrades to Tartcard are the upgrades you see at the start of Halo 5 when Osiris jump out of the Pelican. You know that holographic display that comes down out of the roof?
Good point. Yeah, yeah. The Pimp My Ride moment is pretty cool, where like these two, I think it's Leaks something Leaks, and the Leaks Adjusted, I think it is, or no, Quick to Adjust.
I think it's Ash and Leaks. Leaks Repaired or something.
And it's cool when all this is going on, the Infinity just so casually wipes out a whole bunch of ships and and like the Mac cannon shooting outside the Arbiter thing just wipes out the forces. It's just so amazing.
Like it creates a huge crater too.
What do they call the ship? It has a really cool name. Defender of Faith. Telcam's like backup ship arrives and hovers over the Arbiter's keep, and it's like, this is it, the Arbiter's like, fuck, now we're about to roll into battle. And then,
well, and they had the they have the ventral beam to glass planets, and it's like getting ready to go.
Like she's sitting there, they're gonna invade the keep, they're gonna get the Arbiter, and they're gonna do this. And then Hood and Del Rio are sort of like chilling on the bridge, and he's like, all right, Del Rio, let's do this shit. So they like ping Defender of Faith, and then Defender of Faith like starts to climb into orbit to attack the Infinity, and Del Rio's casually like, you know, missile pods 1 through 3, and that's like 60 missiles that rain down on top of it. And they talk about how Defender of Faith like fires on the Infinity, and you hear the weapons man going like, missiles inbound, missiles tracked, missiles destroyed, and like nothing gets through the Infinity's defense network. And they smash the ship with three salvos of missiles, and then it's damaged and like starting to drop out of the sky, so they smash it with two more salvos and it just comes down in the countryside. And like, this is,
yeah, they must be some missiles, because there's no mention of shields at all here, and this is a ship of significant size and they don't even mention it. So surely it had shields, right?
I think it mentioned the first salvo penetrated the shields but didn't do much damage, but did little damage to the hull, and then the second set destroys it.
So they just overwhelmed it with numbers.
I think it's either that it? Or it's the fact that because they're still in atmosphere and they're coming up through the atmosphere, I assume the shields are like weakened or ineffective because they're coming up through the atmosphere at the Infinity. But I did wonder that myself.
Yeah.
Any time humanity has faced the Covenant, when you do like a massive torpedo salvo, that's usually enough to take out their shields anyway.
Yeah. You can overwhelm the shields with just a lot of damage.
Yeah. They do that. They take the ship out. And then, like you said, Hood next is like, okay, Arbiter, we've taken out that ship. He was like, do you want us to do something about like the guys out at your front door? And Arbiter's like, yes, my friends are still not here. Okay, I'll accept your help. And then they fire a couple of Mac rounds down. And I think Hood says, don't knock the keep down. And the weapons officer's like, that'll push the Mac blast area back into the bay. And he's like, that'll change the coastline. If I was an elite, I would talk about that for a while. So they basically like create a new harbor because they blow holes out of the area in front of the keep.
I love that, just making their mark on the geography of the planet.
And when this happens, Osman has given Telcam the heads up, so he's now fleeing the area.
Barely.
Kilo 5 have to go and collect him, so they're running off the ship, and Vaz has this little internal monologue going on where he's like, you're wrong on this one, Paragoski. We should just nuke the fuck out of them while we're here, drop a few more Mac rounds, wipe out the Arbiter, wipe out Telcam, and leave them struggling for decades.
Yeah. That's true.
This isn't the right move. We should just wipe them out while we're here and now.
As someone who likes the saying Healy in general, this is a hard book to read at times.
It is, because it seems like it's a massive civil war, but when you think about it, half the planet's not involved, and it's actually quite a small scale. I think Rhea is commenting on that in terms of, even though she's not a warrior, she says, where are our fleets? Where are our troops? Where's our... And it does always a sense of, and even I think Del Rio says, are they back in the feudal age already? I mean, it's a big comment on the state of like post-Covenant Sanghelios in terms of like how weakened the race is when it's by itself, when it was so heavily dependent on the Covenant for everything, and even on Hurrigok for everything.
They talk about avoiding what happened to the Covenant with the Hurrigok a lot in this book.
I like that too, that their humanity is aware of the risks of having this wonderful, amazing race that can do almost anything for you, but yet having no control or understanding of what they're doing.
Something that happens during this, there's like little memos scattered through it between different people in the UNSC, and one of them is head of procurement, and he's like, by 2058, I want 2 Hurrigok on every ship in the fleet. And then at a certain point, Parangoski's, yeah, we'll have Hurrigok everywhere, and then we'll start putting explosive collars on them so they don't fall into enemy hands, and then we're the brutes.
Yeah.
I like that.
This is where they start to realise, we can't risk the Hurrigok falling into enemy hands, so we can't deploy them on the front line. And this is where this comes from, which will set up conveniently what happens to the Hurrigok later and why we never see them in like Halo 4 or Halo 5 or anywhere else, because they're relocated to a new project.
Yeah.
Also, they might make the Halo world too simple and too easy. If you just have the easy answer of give it to a Hurrigok and he'll make whatever you want possible, in terms of like, nanobots can do anything you want, do you know what I mean? And it's great.
They're a cop out.
It's good that they're considering that they are the ultimate answer, but there's too few, they're too precious and too important to implement in such a wide scale. So I like that they've roped them in a bit.
I mean, if Brohammer had a Hurrigok, everything would be fine.
Exactly.
We wouldn't have gotten that wonderful trailer.
Don't date the book club, Krista.
Oh, we forgot to mention while we're at it, Jewel has a whole saga.
I was waiting to do that later. Like, we can wrap his stories kind of.
Do you
want to
do his all in one go?
Yeah,
because just wrap up the Sanghelios kind of area.
Telcam gets rescued by Kilo 5. He's not very happy about it, but as Naomi does in usual Naomi style, she roughs him up and handcuffs him and takes him. They get Jewel, and then they get him to message his ships, and they tell him that they need a rendezvous on, I believe they rendezvous on the glass planet that they do the weapons deals on.
Nulaneni, is that it? Or it's in the Brunel system, and it would all giving me vague memories. I'm going to look him up there. You keep talking, buddy.
They get him to rendezvous there. But when they do that, Osman disguises herself as a jackal ship mistress. The Arbiter ships are chasing the last four of Telcam ships out of orbit. And on one of these ships is Rhea and Forze. And conveniently enough, the Arbiter's troops manage to shoot down that ship, which kills Forze and Rhea.
Rip.
It was a cool moment. We touched upon it at the start, but about where Osman pretends to be a Kikar. And that's in order because Telcam is doing deals with Oni and humans, and he doesn't want anyone else in his force to know because everyone hates humans. So he's like pretending that like this is an ally. He's like a mercenary.
Yes, he's hired them because one of the shipmasters says to them like they're going to give us like intel. They're going to track the Arbiter ships and cover our escape. And one of the shipmasters is like, and how much is this going to cost us? And he's like, yeah. No, this is true. And the other thing is Osman's hiding from Infinity because that she also can't reveal that they're doing this because this is all on the sly. She takes out a couple of the Arbiter's ships, but the Arbiter ships manage to take out the ship that they're on. So Rhea and Forze get killed. The other three ships escape, and then Kilo 5 take Telcam to rendezvous with them.
It's a total bummer.
Yeah, so that's like the end of the revolution for now, but like Telcam realizes he has to keep doing business with Oni. They set up then that that's like this arrangement's going to continue until conveniently, side note, we covered this last year, Tales from Slipspace, Knight takes Bishop.
Yeah, where essentially Telcam is assassinated on this planet.
Ooh.
He's still there and Oni send a Spartan 3 to wipe him out. That's spoilers what happens to Avumed Telcam eventually.
Yeah, they had to kind of get rid of him as
they absolutely
character.
Had to wrap it up. He knew way too much.
So we have him there. Kilo 5 go back to Stanley. We now have the upgraded ship. Parangoski goes to Stanley with Adge and Leeks. So they now have two engineers to start making changes. And funny, one of the things they do is make a transparent section of hull. I think BB says they're testing new materials. Oh, funny, by the way, it's one of our bits of trivia later, but the cover of the book, I never put two and two together because I always thought it was like artistic license. But it's actually the scene where Vaz and Naomi talk on the transparent deck while they stand over the Infinity. That's what the cover image is.
I like how Vaz freaks out too.
Yeah, and the way they cover it.
Yeah, like cool. he's talking about it and he's like, my primal brain freaks out and goes, oh, no. And he's like, and of course my intelligent part of the brain goes, clearly this is a transparent section of hull that this ship never had before. Wise up.
Well, and as he's freaking out, Naomi just like strolls onto the deck and is like, yeah, look, it's fine.
It's like, look, I can stand under my Spartan armor. It's all right. Because I think he radios them and he's like, Adge, Leeks, what the hell are you doing to the ship? And Naomi's like, it's fine. It's okay, really. Look, it's fine.
But it's not glass. It's actually transparent metal.
Yes, which will also feature in future parts of the ship. I believe it's the same material that the dome on the Infinity.
Yes.
The Infinity has like a public park on the top of the ship, the atrium. And it's made out of similar things, so it's no longer transparent glass. They don't have to like rough it like the Keys days where you stand at the windscreen and hope that the Covenant don't shoot through it.
No, it's exactly the same material as the hull. The Hergok like change it at the molecular level to make it transparent.
They're testing all this stuff and they've now pimped out Stanley, so Stanley now has the same communications and the same Uber slipspace drive. They wrap up their stuff here and then they pop off back to... No, wait. They pop off back to... We'll have to talk about Jewel now because they go to visit Jewel for a while before.
Yes.
Yeah, Jewel's they do a bunch ending. Of stuff.
So we've got to go back then to Jewel, who you remember was taken hostage.
On Trevelyan.
Yes, he has now ended up... He's been shipped off to Trevelyan and he's now there with... I forgot to write her name down. What is her...
Magson.
This is really devious and it's funny to see like... I kind of did pick up on it, but at the time, you see, Jewel is totally oblivious to what's happening, that they're actually, like, experimenting on him. They're thinking, like, they're developing biological weapons against the Sangheili, testing them out on him, which I think is awesome.
Oh, it's so devious, too, because during this, Jewel's just like, I want you know, grain and meat from my home planet so that I can feel a little better. I don't like the human food. And they're like, oh, okay, we can do that. And so they start lacing the food with poisons and stuff like that. Not anything that's going to...
It's even more devious. They don't even lace it with poisons. They genetically modify it that it's no longer digestible.
Oh, yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah, they don't actually poison it. They actually create a strain that will breed out the current strain on their planet and just replace it with itself, and then they'll starve to death. It's crazy.
Yeah, so when Jules on this, he's throwing up and defecating for days. Like, he's sick for days.
I think they taint them. I don't know if they taint the meat or not, because they...
They did, because some of the Irukan died.
The Irukan, there's the Cholo.
I think it makes the Cholo sick.
Oh.
With the grain, is it?
I think it does the same thing it did to Jule. It makes them sick. They're not able to digest it, therefore they're starving to death.
Yes.
Ah, that makes sense.
But I think it's just the grain, not the meat.
But they were fully ready to deploy this on St. Helios and just like spread it in the crops. And then in a couple years, everyone will die on that planet.
They have a memo from Magnuson where she's just like, this is clearly the easiest way to do this. If you want to take them out, we do it in one swift motion. We wipe them out. You can fight an army, but the quickest way to wipe them out is to stop them being able to produce food. And yeah. Only reason there's a memo about holding off on it is where Parangoski says she doesn't want to taint the ecosystem in case it would spread to future crops that humanity would want to grow on the planet if they ever recolonized.
Oh, it's so shitty. Like, it's really cool Oni stuff, but it's so shitty.
Yeah, and you just know that they have this thing here, and you're, this is the really dark side of Oni. This is, not to mention another book, but this is up there with Last Light and the plague that they're developing in that, where this is the really dark, devious Oni shit that no one really likes.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love that Jule never figures it out, but he does have a great development here of, like, you see he's building his character of why he would hate humanity so much in Halo 4. And then it's like, it's so crazy to see him figure his way out and develop his plan to get out and all that kind of stuff. I thought it was great.
Well, and throughout this whole arc is they're setting up the Didact, who, yeah. It's less of a setup and more of a reintroduction of the Didact. And he hates humanity and, you know, where Requiem is. And
it's teaching the characters in the Halo lore about the Didact, which we already know about, but it's how they're introducing him to the characters in the
story. It's making him, like, relevant, because we see what happens to him in Silentium, but we don't really know what's going on after that. So it's really cool to see that. And also, if you remember in Halo 4, like, Jule Mandama, after this book, has been searching for Requiem for years.
Yeah.
For at least 2 or 3 years, he's been searching for Requiem, trying to find the Didact.
It's funny, he ends up, he finds it at the end of this arc, but he basically spends his time locked out because he can't get into Requiem until a certain green Spartan appears and opens the door.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I remember that.
It's funny to think that, like, they're outside of Requiem for years and then Chief shows up and opens the door for them. And sucks them all in. It's cool.
It's really funny because on the second mission of Halo 4, when you crash land on the planet, you can listen to those audio files, and like one of them is just like, Didact, like over and over and over again. And Cortana's like, they've been broadcasting this message for months or something like that. And it's really funny. They're just like sitting outside the planet being like, open up.
We love you.
The other thing this does is it sets up why Jule hates humanity as much as he does. Because at the start of all this, when he's talking about it with Raya, it's basically, we can't trust them. We can't trust the Arbiter. But by the end of this, it's a seething hatred because fuck him over. And then he's like, I'm going to fuck yous back. And this is his whole, like, driving force. And it also sets up, they mention it in, I think Locke mentions it in Halo 5, that Jule will take any situation that might help to his advantage. So when he met Telcam, he saw religious zealots that he could build an army out of. And then when he gets through this, he ends up on a planet with elites where he's like, I can use you guys to my advantage because you guys
think. Well, and they're religious zealots too.
Yes, they respect the Didact. So he uses his little knowledge of the Didact to twist them to his needs as well.
And build his own little cult.
He builds his own new little covenant.
It's cool. It's right, and that the planet he's on is like was cut off from the Covenant for over a year, so they have no idea what's going on.
Oh no, they've been cut over. Have they not been like cut off really from the Covenant for like, I got the impression they weren't in the Covenant. they sent troops off. I think they say, we sent ships off a few years ago to fight in the Great War.
They were kind of doing their own thing.
They sounded like an outer colony.
Yeah, they're just like, when you think about the size of like an empire, and a galactic empire, there's going to be like the outskirts and the, you know what I mean, the countryside, not the countryside, but you know what I mean, the real out there kind of stuff. So it might have just been, we just, our contribution to the empire is troops whenever they need them or whatever. Otherwise, we kind of get left alone.
Yeah, it had that vibe. I imagine to
it's that kind of thing.
So, it also, a cool thing in this is that he figures out, the way he figures out how to escape is they give him an explosive harness like the engineers had, so that if he disappears for too long when they let him out in the shield world, they'll just remotely detonate it and take him out. So, he figures out that the portals are still active, although they don't go to the right place. They're broken on the other end, and Prone tries to stop him. But he threatens to detonate the harness if Prone won't help him. So he's partially in the portal, and then he forces Prone to take the harness off, and he jumps through. And he luckily, conveniently, ends up at this planet in the right place with the Didact symbol scratched into his belt, so that he manages to have all this come to pass. But this is the moment when we learn then that engineers can't be trusted. And this is another reason why O'Neill take them off the front lines, as they realise while the engineers will be helpful, they have their limits.
Yeah.
You can't rely on them. They won't die for the greater good of the UNSC. They will protect the Forerunner stuff at all costs, even if that means doing the wrong thing for humans.
Mm-hmm.
So this leads to the rather unceremonious end of Magnuson, because Parangoski finds out about all this. She's furious, so she gets Stanley to take her to Trevelyan because she's making a house call, and she basically sends Magnuson off to Midnight Facility.
Yep, she's like, bye.
You have been disappeared. Bye-bye.
And one of the reasons she does this is because she gave Dr. Halsey so many, you're fine, you messed up, but you can keep going. So she's like, I'm not taking that chance anymore, I'm not creating another Dr. Halsey, you're going away.
Yeah, and I like that scene where she gets back out into the Warthog, and, oh, what is the new guy's name?
Oh, I can't remember. The new guy?
Yeah, the guy who's running the show by Legacy of Onyx. She sits there and she's like, so, promotion is basically how that goes.
She's like, okay, by the way, you're running this facility now. Dr. Magson is now relieved Hugo of duty. Hugo Barton.
That's his name, Hugo Barton.
Oh, Hugo Barton. And so Hugo's just like, okay.
Yeah, so he's like, yeah, okay, we're going to run this now. And then I think we're near enough at the end of it, because Jewel escapes. Before he escapes, he has a little quick interaction with Phillips where Jewel realizes, oh, they're all so devious, even this, I forget what they keep calling Phyllis the whole way through it.
Nishum?
Not like Phyllis? Professor.
What are you talking about?
They give him a title. What are they? Scholar. He's like, even the scholar has been twisted by Oni, and then he escapes anyway. So he goes off and he starts to set up his new covenant, and that's his setup for Halo 4. And then Stanley heads back to Venezia because they have to wrap up business. So it's been like a week or two. So they get back to Mike, and Mike's been like keeping on top of things, but keeping quiet. And then Naomi heads down with Vaz?
Out of armor.
So she's going in civilian mode, and they're like, this might work, even though the 6-foot-odd tall, ghostly pale white woman is here. And then, conveniently enough, on their way back to Mike's house, who should they see in traffic? But
her daddy!
Naomi's dad. So they see Stefan Sinski, and he's driving around with, I think Mike calls him, do you know who that buzzard is? This buzzard will become important in the next book. He's important at the minute. This buzzard is called Sav Fell, and he is in charge of, he was given a ship by Telcam to mind and then bring it to the battle at the appropriate time. Pious Inquisitor.
But he stole it.
Yes, instead he smuggled it away off this battleship, and the plan was then to sell it to someone who that someone turns out to be Staffan.
And it's one of the bigger Covenant ships, oh, yeah. Right? Like the cruisers with the ventral beam.
Yes, because they go into it in the next book, but Oni would really like it because they would really like to give Infinity a ventral beam. Although, given how good the engineers are, I'm surprised the engineers didn't just build them one.
But those are engineers that don't know anything about Covenant tech.
Oh, but they do. Adj knows about Covenant tech.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know then.
It's one minor plot hole that they don't mention, but...
Maybe it's just easier for them to use, to just scrap an old Covenant vessel and retrofit it.
Yeah, but they would quite like it, and Staffan would like it, because he wants to take it to Earth, and he wants to get answers off the UNSC and Oni about what they did with his child. Because the whole point of Staffan is that he did not buy the bullshit, and he did not buy that the clone was his daughter, and he doesn't know exactly what is up, but he knows something's up.
And he's going to find out.
He's going to find out, and his way to do it is to buy this big old warship and take it on a wee jolly and get the answers. And then he's also going to give it to the insurrectionists. And then the insurrection will have a big old warship.
That's all covered very well in the next book.
That's pretty much where we wrap up. So we've gone kind of long. So I think we'll do some thoughts and then we'll bounce on this one because we've gone for a bit.
Hey.
So what do we think? Thoughts on this book? Do we enjoy it? Do we not enjoy it?
This book is definitely like... If you could only read one of these three books to lead up to Halo 4, this is the one that has all of the Halo 4 information, really.
Yeah. Funnily enough, Glasslands is more relevant to Halo 5 because it explains how Blue Team came back.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the thing people don't like about this book, and I don't mind it as much, they don't like the Halsey stuff because...
It's not as bad in this book.
Well, the hate Halsey stuff isn't as bad, but they break Halsey in this book.
Yeah, well, BB's like watching her cry herself to sleep.
BB's kind of fucked up.
I like showing the human side of Halsey even a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Do you see her breakdown and they say that she's crying over Miranda, that she's crying? I mean... You want to see that? You want to believe that Halsey can be a mother even to her own daughter when, you know, she's sad, like broken that her daughter has been killed? That's a big deal. And you never get to see it or touch upon it because I think we've mentioned before in Halo, it's funny to think that Halo Reach is the first time you see Halsey in a game and she's such a massive character.
Yeah.
And she exists like exclusively in the book. So it's good to see a book go there. And I know the Halsey hate in this trilogy is pretty hardcore, but... I think in this book, she was only in it for half a second, essentially, when BB and Glassman had a quick conversation with her about trying to repair his fragment.
And it's like BB's like, I hate this woman, and then just pretty much says, take me away.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think Halsey and Perengoski hate each other so much because they're so similar.
But even I think it's also because Perengoski says she's great lines of explaining the situation of her feelings towards Halsey, where on one hand, you're saying, yes, Halsey, unbelievably terrible person, did horrible things, blah, blah, blah. But none of that would have been possible if there wasn't people like me letting it happen.
Yeah.
So she was totally, obviously she was aware of the things that she was asking Halsey to do. So like, and even she was signing them off and letting all this stuff happen. So she also is in the blame before that. And you see Perengoski explaining kind of the way she's changing in her later life in terms of like trying to make up for some of these things and how she's setting certain things up and, you know, trying to help Saren as much as she can. And it's interesting.
Perengoski's getting ready to die. She's like doing all of her unfinished business. And her last great regret in life is that she thought she'd missed her chance to get Halsey and get back at her because...
Yeah.
Halsey pushed the boat, she crossed the line one too many times is Halsey's problem, as she thought she was so indispensable that she was untouchable.
Yeah.
At a certain point, Perengoski's just like, well, I created this monster, so I have to sort it out. But at the same time, Perengoski's not repentant. She's like, I would do it again if I had to.
Do it all again.
Yeah.
Because it saved us all in the end.
I like Perengoski.
Perengoski's fantastic.
She's so cool. And just the way she kind of deals with everything. Like, she's a little crotchety 90-year-old woman, but everyone's just totally afraid of her.
And hanging off her word is awesome.
When she intimidates Del Rio on the Infinity and she talks about how she comes up behind him and talks over his shoulder and he can feel her breath on his ear and she's like, when I was a younger, more attractive woman, sometimes people mistook this for flirting, but now that I'm old and horrifying, this is only the scariest shit ever, and it's great.
Yeah.
Oh, she's so
and
good.
And there's a couple
she's
of times
so
where she's
amazing.
Talking, she's like, I forget what she does, but she offers someone biscuit. It's her assistant at the start. By the way, we will have a discussion briefly about the ginger nut thing at the start. She's talking about ginger nuts and she's talking about her assistant. She has this whole long section about how ginger nuts are the perfect biscuit and all this, which I don't know if Americans know what ginger nut biscuits are.
No, we do not.
They're a hard-baked ginger biscuit. They're fantastic. They're really nice.
They're to dip in tea, right?
Apparently
tea
they're awesome
coffee.
For dipping in mochas, yes. And she like tells her assistant because she says he comes in, he's like, here's your mocha and your... ginger nuts. And she's like, he says it like it's a perversion. And she's like, go have some, you'll enjoy them. And she's like, oh great, I've turned from scurry only lady to nice granny offering the children some food.
Yeah.
That's kind of how she, like, if someone's doing really good for her, that's kind of what she is to them. Like,
yeah, she's become
to Osmond,
that way.
She's like the really nice grandma that gives her ginger, like candied ginger.
Yeah.
But to people that are not doing well for her, she's like the devil incarnate.
Yeah. She ships you off to Midnight Facility.
Yeah, you've got Osmond. She likes Osmond. She's got Phillips and Mike. Like, the rest of Kilo 5, she's not fuzzy to, but, like, Mike calls her Big Maggie, and that's how you know that Mike's yeah. been around a long time, because he calls her that. And then, funny, I think there's one time on the Bridge of the Infinity where she says something, and she's like, and Hood gives her the don't corrupt the children look.
Oh, yeah.
She's talking about coming back and wiping them all out and stuff like that, and how easy it would be, and everybody's like,
nope, I think Parangoski's fantastic. Parangoski and I think Bibi are probably my favourite characters through this whole thing. Although Phillips,
I think Osmond and Naomi
well.
Become really good by the end of the next book, but right now it's definitely all about Parangoski and Bibi.
Naomi hasn't really had that much time to shine, even though some of the most significant things in this trilogy happened to her and around her. And I think Saren Osmond is an amazing character who it's great to see her develop up, because we know where she goes. And it's also great to see kind of that Spartan 2 washouts and kind of where they go. And do you know what I mean? They're also amazing. They kind of make a thing to note that, like, these children were taken at the beginning because they were so amazing already.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to see that it's not just the Spartan program, but it's also the people they were or had the potential to be. So it's cool to see a character like that.
It's like Vazir Mal thinking about Naomi, and they're like, she would never be happy in a backwater community being a truck driver or something like that. Even if she never knew what the Spartan program was, she's an incredible human that needs to do something with her life.
And on that note,
I think, yay. We should, like, wrap this up. So overall, we like this. We all good. We all positive.
Oh, yeah. The Kilo 5 trilogy is amazing.
It's great. And like I said, I've said before, the only thing I dislike about it is the Halsey hate, but it wasn't even that much in this book.
Oh, it's all Glasslands that's Halsey hate.
Yeah, and I do love the build up to all these characters in Halo 4, and I'm feeling it more now because I'm starting Halo 4 again in a fresh light and for Mission Debrief, and it's fascinating to see all these lore connecting and just how much of it there was going into Halo 4 that I was originally oblivious to.
Yeah.
It's cool to see all these characters and all this story, and Karen Travis does a great job, obviously, of giving us these characters. It's cool. It's going to make Halo 4 again better. Good book. Love it.
All right. Will that do us for this week?
Yeah, that'll do us.
That'll do us for another
that'll
one.
That'll do us.
All right. Okay, apparently I'm exiting this show, David. Sorry, I took over. I stole your bit.
That's all right, buddy. You can do your thing.
We will wrap up for this week. If you get a chance, please pop over to the website, thehalopodcastevolve.com. You can check out all of our stuff there, including the awesome information that Ian has related to Thursday War and the Kilo 5 books, names, dates, locations. I may have used some of those to make the notes for this week's show.
Oh, very random piece of trivia. That is amazing. That the release date for this novel is exactly 343 days after the release date of Grasslands. That seems ridiculous.
Did they plan that? They must have.
Yeah, they got it.
So what we're saying is every book in future will be 343 days after the previous book?
No.
I'm pretty sure it's a one-off.
Damn it. All right, well, anyway, we're wrapping up. Yes, go there. You'll get all of our stuff. You'll get all of our social things. You'll also get the links to the Patreon and everything else. I think will that do us?
I think that'll do us.
Hang on, before we do Evolved, our next book club will be... Will it be Mortal Dictata?
It'll be Mortal Dictata.
It will be.
I'll start reading today.
Excellent. Okay, join us on the next book club for Mortal Dictata then. Evolved?
Evolved!